Hey everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. We have a varied show for you, a lot of topics we're going to be hitting on this week. Before we begin, I want to let you know that our show is sponsored by ChristianCafe.com this week. For those of you that have not yet tried Christian Cafe, please do so. You can either go through the link that we provide, or you can go to ChristianCafe.com and enter the promo code BOUNDLESS for an extended trial period that is available to Boundless folks and friends. So make sure you check it out and let us know what you think. Later on in the show, Martha and I are going to be doing a Q&A about finding a church because we have had to do that before. So, right?
We're highly experienced.
We are highly experienced. We're church hoppers. We just sample churches. No, we don't. No, we settled into churches. That's good. Yeah. But we've had to be there and figure out what really does that look like to find qualities in a church that are ultimately are going to be a good fit for you. So we will help you with that. Then for our culture segment, I am talking to Michael Homula. He is the president of ICU Mobile. They are out putting mobile ultrasounds through in these RVs. It's like total nuttiness, the ministry that they have, and are going to abortion-minded women and getting them ultrasounds and basically saving babies. So All those scary clinics that no one wants to walk into, bless them. We still love you. You're still valuable. But they're taking these RVs and going out directly to the women on college campuses and elsewhere where women may be intimidated to walk into a building. So good stuff there. We'll be talking to him. And right now for our roundtable, we have a fun group of folks because we're going to actually talk about being friends with married people. You know, I mean, we all know single people are better and we like to be with our own kind, but we appreciate married people as well.
And sometimes so married people are all you have to settle for, you know?
We brought two married people into the studio.
But not to each other.
Yeah, no, not married to each other.
Good clarification.
Two married people. But you know what? They were also single once. So they're going to be able to talk from both perspectives on that. So Amanda Klontz is here in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome back,
I should say.
Thanks.
She's been on the show before, as well as our own blogger, Adam Holtz. Hey.
Glad to be back.
Good to have you here. And Martha's here with me as well.
Hello, Lisa.
Hello. Because Martha and I have married friends occasionally when we get desperate. I'm just teasing. So the first question I'm going to ask.
I feel so welcome.
I know. Isn't that awesome?
So Dave is our friend.
He's looking at
Dave is our friend too. But, you know, I talk to Dave about cruises and other things like that. He's a good resource for me. He's married. He's been married a long time. He doesn't even remember what it was like to be
single. Since the earth was still cooling, probably.
he just puts up with us. So, okay, so for my first question, you two marrieds have to put on your singles hat because I want to know, because I know, Adam, you were involved in singles groups for a long time. You were totally plugged in. And Amanda, you just seem to have friends of all stripes. I mean, you're just like friends.
You just
walk down
folks.
The halls of work like, goodness gracious, who doesn't know her? So I want to know from you guys, first of all, did you marrieds have married friends when you were single? Let's just talk generally about kind of from this perspective of a single person, what is it like to look at the marrieds and feel like, are these people I can be friends with? What was intimidating about that? What wasn't? And, you know, now that you're there, you have a different perspective. But what was that like looking back?
I think that one of the dynamics I realized fairly early when my friends started getting married was there was this sort of expectation that you had graduated, you know, you got to leave the singles group and go to the young marrieds group and never the twain should meet, you know. And so I think I had several friends that got married that we really wanted to challenge that and say, you know, do you have to just leave this community that you've spent so much time investing in and just go be with your own kind? And so I had several sets of friends that got married that still hung out with the singles group that we were involved in. And some people even had questions about that because it sort of diluted the purpose of the group. But I think it was really healthy and just to be able to get a chance to see what their marriages looked like in those early years was a really good thing for me.
Yeah, I really appreciated the friendships that I had with married folks as a single person. Although I do remember times when, you know, especially their first year of marriage, they're spending naturally more time together than the spouses together than with their friends. And so I do remember thinking, well, can't you guys just hang out with us? Like, what are you doing all that time? You know, like, seriously, you're married now, you live together. Why do you have to be around each other 24/7? And so, but now on the married side, I understand that you do need to, you know, bond with your spouse, especially that first year. But so it is like a catch 22. And you really, I think both audiences or both groups have to be really sensitive to the other person's needs and that sort of thing. And as I mean, I've just been married, let's see, since last February, so a little over a year. And it is a struggle, especially that first year, to balance the time with friends, even other married friends, and to balance the time with my spouse. So it is a hard thing, and I understand it more now. But there were times when I thought that it was really unfair, for sure.
I think the trend often starts even when two people are dating. There's a bit of a separation, which I can understand, too. But by the time they get married, it's kind of, you maybe have already moved on to establish some other friendships.
I know with me, there was always that struggle of almost like a jealousy of like my friend being taken away by this guy or whatever. Because I had several friends who got married and moved away because this guy was either from another state or he got a job there. And then it was like, not only are you taking my friend by marriage, but you're geographically taking her away now. And now I'm just left by myself and I have to start over, you know, and that was hard. And it's been hard to keep up with some of those friends, you know, when you don't have that proximity. That's, I think, a whole new challenge in that. So that can definitely be difficult. What would you say, for example, what did your friendships look like then? I mean, with married people, I mean, how, or do they, you know, Martha and I, we're kind of in that boat right now. How do you navigate that and how do you make it work?
Babysit their kids.
There you go. No, then you're just friends with their kids.
I know. I mean, if I were to say something to married folks, I would say, you know, keep that friendship going too, beyond just the services.
Beyond just come take care of my kids.
But also at the same time, I think when you show interest in people's pets and their kids, that it, you can build a friendship pretty quickly.
Yeah, true.
Well, and I think that brings up a really interesting point. I think it's important to distinguish between married friends who don't have kids, you know, who've just sort of maybe moved on from a community or a group where it was mostly singles in a church, and now they're married, to those who do have kids. Because I know when my wife and I got married, we were still very much involved with ministry to singles. And so it didn't really feel like that much had changed. Mm-hmm. And we still had a lot of availability to stay out late, to be spontaneous, to kind of do, you know, the way singles do life. But once you have kids, I think spontaneity becomes much more difficult. And I think for married people to keep maintaining those friendships, they're going to have to take initiative. And I think the challenge for singles is to try to be understanding. And it's hard. And it's like, if it's hard when they sort of pull away from the group at first, in some ways it's even harder when they have kids because you just don't have that much time available. So I know that I have several fairly close single friends that have stayed engaged with my wife and I, and sometimes they've expressed frustration that our schedule's just hard. And so I think singles maybe have to be forgiving, and married people, I think, need to keep reaching out, keep engaging, keep inviting people, single people into their lives.
Well, I think I've just decided that I have like the lamest house ever for families, because like whenever I invite people over that have kids, it's like my whole house is either hardwood or tile, so someone's kid is gonna fall on the floor and break their head open.
But if they throw up, it'll bounce off the floor, which happened at a party that I was
totally
at last
good.
Weekend.
So. I can totally mop stuff up, no big deal. I also have no good toys. I have no good seating areas. I have tons of things that are breakable, and I'm just like, where can I have these people? You know, where maybe we need to meet in a neutral location, and then I feel super lame about it. So do I need to like kid-proof my house? I don't know. I don't know how to do this.
I mean, my husband and I have even dealt with that as married people who don't
you
have
want
kids.
Toys when you go over to your friend's house.
Right. We really request specific toys. But, you know, friends of ours who do have kids now coming over to our house, and we're always like, sorry, bring their toys with you. You know, it's just, I think that's not even just a single person problem. It's, it's definitely something.
I have a closet full of toys.
I know.
Martha, you should all be like Martha.
Martha's so amazing. Cool. Martha brings like a bag of toys when she goes visit.
I should do that.
It's like Santa Claus.
I know. She is. Like, Auntie Martha, here she comes.
Well, and I think on both levels, it's just messy.
Right.
Like, when you're in the same place in life, you have a shared set of experiences, you understand each other, you kind of know where the other person's coming from. And when all of a sudden you're in sort of different situations, I think both sets of people have to make adjustments. And I know for us, and maybe this is slightly more my wife's issue than mine, you know, before we invite somebody over, we want to make sure the place is clean and picked up and not just the general, you know, landmines everywhere that it usually is. And I think that we've gotten more comfortable saying, look, life with three small children is messy. Mm-hmm. And if we want to share our lives with you, I don't think we always have to get it all looking absolutely perfect. And so I think we've gotten more comfortable just sort of having people drop by and hang out and sorry about the mess, don't step on that. And and just learning to understand that if we're going to have those relationships continue, It is kind of messy sometimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will say that I recently went over to a couple from my church, invited me over for lunch, and they have a number of kids. I don't even know how many. Wow, more than two, more than three, probably.
a gaggle.
But yeah, a total gaggle. And I went there, and I was like, I walked into their house, and I was like, wow, this place is like a mess. And yeah. it was almost kind of awesome because I was like, wow, they are not. In fact, as we walked in the house,
you should come to
church,
our house.
It was it's beyond after church. Awesome. He like went to quickly clean the bathroom while she just started pulling out random paper plates and napkins and stuff. And I was like, you know what? He's like a doctor. And I'm like, shoot, they could like, you know, hire someone to clean. But they didn't. They just want to be like normal, like in their life and stuff. And I was impressed by that. And I was like, they're inviting me into something that's like normal because I live alone and my house is like a mess. I don't understand where who's making the mess because I'm never there. But so I was just impressed by that. So I want to know, you guys that are now married, what, when you were anticipating getting married, did you expect that things were going to change, or did you have any fears or any kind of like, oh, I'm going to have to kind of wrangle this situation, or think of specific relationships that you were going to try to preserve or try to carry on? What was your thought process in that?
Well, I think just having been a part of friends' lives who did get married before me, and knowing that those things, those relationships changed, and it's just a natural change, but they do change. I think I expected that, and I knew that it might be hard to balance friendships with my relationship with my husband. And I'm also friends with some females who really want to be married, and part of it is a hard, you know, it's just a hard balance because I want to be sensitive to them and that desire that they have. And I know that they don't want me to not talk about my relationship either, so it's just a hard balance, and luckily we've had open communication about it, so we can keep checking in on how, you know, how you're feeling when this friend announces their engagement or pregnancy or whatever it might be. And so I think that's just been really important, is open communication, constant like, am I being sensitive to your needs, are you being sensitive to mine, kind of thing. And I think that's really helped and preserved friendships for sure, that in the last year and a half, you know, since I've been married.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think just trying to go in with your eyes open and knowing that things probably are going to change. But I don't think you have to be fatalistic about it. I don't think you have to say, oh, now it's all going to just be different and different is bad.
Marriage ruins everything.
Marriage ruins everything. And on the other hand, there's less time for a relationship. I don't have time to sit up till 3 a.m. talking about, you know, if you get into a deep conversation with somebody when you go out for coffee and you want to just hang out and keep talking about it, it's like, no, kids got to go to bed, you know, exactly. And, so I think that, again, you have to be more intentional because there are a lot more boundaries on how much time you have available. But I think that if you're intentional, you can still carve out really significant time to really devote to those relationships.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Martha kind of alluded to this. She kind of broke the ice on this one, but let's talk frustrations. So frustrations of single people with their married friends and vice versa, kind of maybe some preconceived notions we have or just ideas about the relationships where we may feel like, oh yeah, this isn't going to work, or I'm just done with that, or it's going to so be changed that it's too much work or something like that. What do you guys think?
I don't think I get as frustrated anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, you kind of get used to it. Mm-hmm. The older you get, you know, that there are going to be changes in people. Yeah. So, I don't know. I think I've come just more to an acceptance and take the time that you get and make other friends. And
Yeah, and it's interesting because just the friends that I know in this town, there was a time when I first moved here, probably the first 2 years, I wasn't dating anybody, and it was just a bunch of single people hanging out. And over the past few years, like, people have started pairing off out of that group and getting married. And it's interesting because I feel like the single people, they still hang out and do their thing and don't always invite the married people because they just maybe assume we don't want to come or whatnot. And then there is a tendency to feel like, okay, if there's a bunch of couples and there's this one single friend we want to invite, should we? Do they want to come? Do they want to be around us? And some of them have communicated like, yes, of course we do. Why are you making it weird? You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting. And I think for me, the single friends that I have, and I don't know if I project this on them or not, but sometimes I feel like, are they just totally frustrated with me? But at the same time, my marriage is my priority. There's still a value. And so it's really hard for me sometimes to think about the balance between that. And I'm expecting a child now, but don't have any yet. And I'm sure that's just going to complicate the whole situation. So
it's a good complication.
Adam, you'll have to give
me your
tips.
All the time we can now with Amanda. Yeah. Because who knows, we might be written off after that. No.
I think I've had to battle a few times where I felt like my single friends have gotten frustrated with me, mm-hmm. and I have to be careful not to respond in turn and just sort of, you know, start listing the litany of things that life demands of me. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's probably on my shoulders to just be understanding and to try to mm-hmm. just keep saying, hey, I still really value our relationship. And I'm sorry that if it's sometimes feels like I'm not very available, and it feels like that because I'm not very available. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels like that for a reason. They're mm-hmm. not imagining that. And trying to keep those lines of communication open and just doing things that say, yeah, this relationship
right.
really matters.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I would add, you know, for singles to keep in mind is to say yes to the invitations that do come. I mean, whether it's a baby shower or it's going to a kid's birthday party or whatever, like, step into that and have fun with it. And, like, mm-hmm. don't feel like, oh, I'm going to be the third wheel or automatically think that's going to be awkward. Like, hey, they want you there. Go have yeah. a fun time.
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. And I think to the extent that we can create and contribute to communities that really don't make this sharp division. And right. I know it's natural to sort of hang with our own kind. I think that we look for our tribe pretty much wherever we go. But I think it's really healthy for singles and marrieds to interact together. And I think that would be worth challenging in our church cultures because they're often totally mm-hmm. segregated from each other. And so just learning how to do that, I think, would help with some of these dynamics.
Yeah. I would say it would be better when you're hanging out with the married people if the married people do not just focus on the lack of that person's
oh, yeah.
love life.
That's yeah.
I get
really
into a lot
point.
Of dinner parties, too, where yeah. it's like, let's find someone for Lisa.
Yeah.
Or
it becomes
let's figure
patronizing.
Out what, yeah, you know, kind yeah. of. And I mean, I think a lot of married couples are now clued into that a little bit more so, but that's always helpful when you can see the single person beyond, you know,
yeah,
beyond just their relationship status, you know, or yeah.
yeah,
lack thereof. I think one of my frustrations, and it's probably something I need to work on, is kind of that idea of, you know, it's funny because I have friends that have gotten married, and especially like we talked about before, after they have kids, they will always say to me, it's always this talking about like, Lisa, your life and the lives of your single friends are all so exciting. You guys have all this time and you have to do so many fun things and you blah, blah, blah. But then I invite them to do something with us. And then it's like, well, I can't because my husband this or what, you know, or like women that are like, I can only vacation now with my husband. So, you know, we'll do like a little girls weekend or something. And they're like, well, I don't know. I have to see if my husband can babysit the kids. And I'm like, you know what? I thought it was called parenting. Your husband is not a babysitter. You know, so it's just kind of funny. It's like this whole, like, let me see if my husband can take over, you know, or
yeah.
And I'm like, I think guys are competent. I think they can do that, you know.
Mostly.
So, yeah.
Well, that's something I've really appreciated. One of my friends who is single, her parents have a little, well, it's not little, it's a large cabin up in the mountains. And she's made a point every year for the past 3 years to just invite a whole group of girls. Some of us are married, some not, some have kids, some not. And we've just really enjoyed going up there, hanging out, just being, you know, enjoying that female community, no matter what our life stage is. Hmm. And she's just really intentional about it. And I have always just appreciated that. And it's so, I mean, she's still a person, and I'm friends with her now for the same reasons I was friends with her when we were both single, you mm-hmm. know, so mm-hmm. I appreciate her making the effort. For
yeah,
sure.
That's good. So kind of as we wrap here, let's just give, because you kind of kicked it off there, Amanda, what are some good pieces of advice to both marrieds and singles, just from perspective as to how we can better facilitate relationships between one another? What are some of your expectations? What would be helpful? What's a good time frame to do things? You know, because we probably don't understand your world as well as we'd like to think. I mean, Adam, do you have, I mean, like you said, it's more difficult now. I mean, do you have guy friends? I mean, did you...
Do you have friends anymore?
I still have some.
I have Facebook friends.
Okay. That is not the same.
I know. I have a couple guys that I hang out with mm-hmm. Fairly regularly, one of whom is single. Mm-hmm. And we spend actually quite a lot of time together. And I think be intentional, be forgiving, be willing to deal with each other's messiness. Singleness is messy in a different way than married, and married mm-hmm. with children is messy. And just being willing to enter into each other's worlds and understanding that's where we're at and things are changing, but that doesn't mean it has to be a change for the worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say just to add to that, that just communication is so important because it's easy yeah. to assume someone's thinking something or they don't want to be somewhere in a situation when just ask, you know, and be sensitive to how a situation with maybe a lot of married people might make a single person feel
yeah.
or vice versa or whatever. Just I think communication is just so important in relationships.
Mm-hmm. And I would say celebrate and have joy of if going to weddings or, I mean, the showers. There's always billions of showers to go to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But people just keep having babies.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Mean, yeah, but that's good. I love babies. But I have that focus off of yourself onto other people and enjoy the different life stages as people go through them. And yeah, mm-hmm. it makes life more fun.
Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, I would say for the married folks, definitely to keep in mind that you're probably going to be asked to have, you know, some discomfort as well, kind of mm-hmm. like what Adam alluded to. You know, it's I have a lot of married friends that all of a sudden it's like paralyzing for them to not be doing something with their husband or to break into a group where they don't have their significant other with them. And I'm like, you know, what single girls, we're usually the uncomfortable ones. So be uncomfortable. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is my life, basically being the, you know, the odd one out or whatever. Or and also just find, you know, think, even if you have to proactively think of topics of conversation ahead of time that maybe you could ask good questions of your single friends and, you know, not have it be just a list of what your kids are like doing 24/7, you know, all the time. Though I think singles need to ask those questions too and be interested in their family. And I really appreciate one of the couples at my church, another couple that a few of us girls were going, single girls were going out for lunch after church one day, and they drove up in their van and they said, "Where are you guys going? Because we are busting this thing up." And they just invited themselves along. And I thought that
That's
was so
awesome.
Great,
That's
you know, to
fun.
Not let us be cliquish in that and to not let us perpetuate that whole, oh, well, you know, we're going to just stay like with like. So definitely be willing to bust in. And now I'm going to have them and some other couples over for
to your non-child-friendly house
lunch after church to my non-child-friendly house, and the kids are just going to have to sit there looking at books.
They can do
yeah. Tops, race cars. There's, you know, lots of things that hardwood floors are good
boxes.
For.
That's yeah. very true. That's true. No, you know what I have? I have one of those huge exercise balls. And
oh yeah.
Little, like babies
that's
just
gold.
Love like crawling after
yeah.
it. So
yeah.
that's one of my
so
choice.
Do 6-year-olds.
No, so do 6-year-olds. So yeah. So, of course, then they'll like climb on top of
they
it.
Do.
And burp over.
Yeah, well,
so, but whatever. Just... I'm gonna have everyone sign waivers.
Yeah.
That'll be my next action. So, well, good thoughts, you guys. Thanks so much for being honest and open about your feelings, especially those of you that have crossed that divide, and give some good ideas for Martha and I too as we navigate that space. So awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Here's my life, Lord. Speak what is true. Speak what is true. Speak what is true.
Well, hey everyone. We are here for this week's culture segment, and I'm very pleased to have a new guest to the Boundless Show who's here in person visiting from out east. I discovered that I really can't say that is out east, no longer just the Midwest, the realm of Ohio. So Michael Homula, welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Lisa. It's great to be here.
Very good to have you. Michael is the executive director of ICU Mobile, which is, well, I'm going to let him talk a little bit about that, but we wanted to kind of pull him in for a number of reasons. One, because as you all know, being Boundless and certainly a subset, a ministry of Focus on the Family, we are very passionate about life and the gospel here at Boundless. Let's just give up a little collective cheer for that. Woo-hoo! So passionate about that, but also very fascinating story in Michael's own story, as well as being a guy kind of in our generation, single guy who is now leading a ministry. And so we're going to want to talk about a little bit about that too, because
sure.
we like to ferret y'all out when we find when we find you, you know, people that are being legit, you know, that's good. We're into that. So, Michael, and I do want to let people know, you know, and I'll tell you this at the end too, but go check out the site. It's ICU, the three letters, mobile.org. So you can find out, even as you're listening, kind of what we're talking about here, because it's really, really a great ministry. And I have liked it on Facebook. I would like some credit for that.
Facebook is a great place. You hear the stories right there.
Exactly. So, okay. So, Michael, I know that a lot of this and your involvement with ICU is born out of your own story. And so can you just briefly tell us a little bit of your testimony and how you kind of got passionate about life and how you really do integrate it to where you came from?
Sure. Well, the first part of the story is that I was adopted. And so I was kind of passionate about life from that perspective, that, you know, I had been given an opportunity to live. I didn't know the circumstances of my adoption as a child, but so I was passionate about life, and I got active in the pro-life cause in my early 20s. largely because of the story I'll share with you, which is that my birth mother was the victim of a rape, and I was the product of that rape. She conceived me out of a rape. She was at an office party in Cleveland, Ohio. And she was married at the time, and her husband was in Vietnam fighting in the war. And she found herself pregnant, obviously unplanned. She wrote a letter to her husband saying, you know, I was raped and I'm now pregnant. And he wrote her a beautiful letter that said, you know, I support whatever you decide to do. If you'd like to have an abortion, we'll do that. If you want to plan for adoption, we'll do that. If you want to raise this child as our own, we'll do that. And when I was 21, I started to learn this story through a crazy set of circumstances that's too detailed to go into now. But I had an opportunity to realize that my birth mother was considering abortion. And that was a very sobering moment to realize that the chance that you're even breathing air is so infinitesimal that, you know, you were within just a momentary decision of not being here. And that kind of ignited a charge in me. I was not saved at the time, but I was certainly now passionate about the life issue and looked at abortion as the taking of a human life. And so I was confronted now with the reality of the fact that my breathing air had some purpose. Not saved, I didn't quite get it, but I had a purpose.
So it was not too many years ago, I think. I mean, you were in the world of business and doing all that. Kind of what prompted the switch and how did you get involved in, you know, to really take a big step to go into full-time ministry?
Yeah, I gave my life to Jesus Christ in August of 2003. I was 33 years old at the time, and I gave my life to the Lord, and I felt called to ministry, but some folks around me were like, you know, hey, you don't want to have an emotional reaction to your conversion, end up a missionary in Central Africa and be like, hey, God, I love you, but not here. So I kind of backed away at that time. Went back to my business career. I had a very nice business career. I'd been in business for almost 18 to 20 years. And then in 2008, I started feeling kind of disrupted that something wasn't quite right vocationally. And I began to pray. And it was in that time the Lord spoke to me and said, you know, Michael, I called you and you didn't throw it on your nets. You didn't go do what I wanted you to do, but I've got a plan for you. And it's going to be kind of wild. It's going to be it's going to be great. It's going to be full of me, but it's not going to be fun. It may have a cost for you. And so, but I expect you to say yes. So I prayed and I began to shut my business down at the time and waiting on God for what he wanted to do. I was then introduced to the ministry of ICU Mobile. In a strange set of circumstances, but they needed a business plan written. And I came in through a friend to maybe look at maybe helping them write their business plan. I found out they had an executive director role open. They asked if I'd help them fill it. And I wasn't thinking of myself at the time, but I agreed to do that. And then about 10 days later, the founder contacted me and said, I think I've been praying. I think the Lord wants me to hire you as the executive director. And in ministry, I saw how Jesus would handle a woman in a crisis pregnancy. And so I began to realize that this was God weaving my story of my conception all the way through my giving my life to Christ in 2003. And now he was about to, that wild, great plan he kind of promised me in 2008 suddenly came to reality and fruition.
Yeah. How, and let's back up here just a minute, because I would like you to explain this too, a little bit of how you did come to Christ. I mean, how, really how that change came about in your life, anyone that was involved in that, and kind of what happened, you know, in the wake of that?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a Catholic home, and so I was churched, but, you know, I didn't have a personal relationship with Jesus. And by the time I was 17, 18, my parents were like, look, you know, we've raised you to be in the Catholic Church, but, you know, it's your decision now. So I just kind of left the church. I just had no personal connection to it. Went about living my life. I was 32. I was the vice president at a bank in Ohio, and the IT guy that worked on my computer was a Christian, and we just got to be friends around music mostly. We just had some of the same taste in music, and went on a missions trip to Macedonia, and he came back, and I was interested in what he did, and it was an opportunity for him to tell me why he was there, which is, of course, the gospel. He invited me to his church in Akron, Ohio. It's the chapel, and I went. It was the 5:30 service on a Sunday night, so it was this uber contemporary, you know, worship. It was like a rock concert, you know, and that just blew my mind coming from the hymnals of the Catholic Church. And but I was hooked. You know, I heard the gospel for the first time, and I went on a journey then. I got a Bible, and I read it. And then I was like, okay, is this true? And I read Flavius Josephus. I'm a total history nerd, so I had to see that. And then I started studying the archaeological record. It was about an 18-month-long process. And by the time I got to the end of that, I was just confronted with the total reality that this book was true. Now I had to wrestle with, who was Jesus? Was this guy really the Son of God? Did he really die and rise from the dead? And as I opened up Lee Strobel's Case for Christ, that was the linchpin, you know. That was July. And then next thing I know, I'm on my knees at a park just begging Christ into my life and confessing. And so that's kind of how it happened for me. It was a bit of a process, but all along I see how God was using people in my life to plant seeds.
That's great. Well, we were, several of us were out to lunch and we were talking kind of about the issue of abortion and how it's dealt with today, especially among Xers and millennials. And we were talking kind of about that malaise and that, you know, the static noise that so many young adults feel they hear because they think of all the legislation that's been, you know, argued about and all the things that have happened and Roe v. Wade and, you know, all of this. And they're like, oh, just don't talk to me about it anymore. Let's start by you giving us a profile. What is the average, if there is an average abortion-minded woman today? Who are you seeing? Because we're going to talk a little bit about what ICU does, but what is out there when we think of, you know, women who are considering abortion?
Well, you know, the thing is that there's no stereotype for this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the problems with the Christian folks in our country, those who follow Jesus, they sometimes have a stereotype of about what a woman looks like who has an abortion. They tend to think they're poor. They tend to think they're minorities. They tend to think they're 15 to 21 years old. But the reality of this is that this is an issue that's affecting all walks of life, 15 to 44-year-olds in some cases. And they're white middle class, they're white upper class, they're black lower class, they're all over the map. And so there's no one standardized profile. These are women who, for a variety of reasons, have found themselves in an unplanned pregnancy. Their lifestyle choices, some of the things that they've chosen to do, have led them now to be pregnant. And they're confronted with the financial difficulties of that, the social difficulties of that. Some of them want, you know, to continue their careers, and the baby's going to get in the way of that. They're in college, and they don't want that to stop their educational plans. So, you know, there's no one standard profile to say that this fits the bill for an abortion-determined women. The one thing that is fairly consistent, though, is that they don't have a real close relationship with Jesus or no relationship with Jesus at all. Mm-hmm. Because those who really do have a tight walk with the Lord, while they may sin, they understand this is life, and abortion's just not on the radar screen for them.
Hmm. Wow. So let's look a little bit at what ICU does then, because I think what you guys do in this realm is pretty unique. So talk about kind of the vision for it, how it began, and then really where you guys are right now.
Yeah, the vision of the beginning of our ministry is one of the most amazing stories I've ever come across. And our founder, Sylvia Slifko, I wish she could be here with us because she tells the story way better than I do. But she was the director of a pregnancy center in Akron, Ohio, and she was pretty frustrated that she wasn't seeing enough of these women who are having abortions coming in the doors of her center. Sylvia's a prayer warrior, and so she began to pray. And it was in that time that the Lord spoke to her and said, Sylvia, if you want to reach these women, you've got to go to them. You can't wait inside of a building for them to come to you. By the way, that's very Jesus. By the way, Jesus was a guy who went to people. You know, he was God who went to people. It's pretty awesome. But anyway, so Sylvia heard God speak to her, and he said, you know, put an ultrasound machine in an RV and go to the women of the Akron community and bring them free pregnancy tests and free ultrasounds. Even gave her the name for it, said, call it ICU, mm-hmm. as in I see you in the womb. Mm-hmm. So Sylvia went to her husband, Steve, and said, I think God wants us to do this. And they looked around the country and said, certainly someone has to be doing this. Turns out no one was. And so they set out to try to accomplish this goal. 9 months to the day from when Sylvia got this vision, we deployed the very first mobile ultrasound vehicle in the world. We were the first ever to do it. I don't boast in that for us. It was God who did it all, but we just happened to be the ones he chose to do it first. Sylvia knew she couldn't brand the mobile with that typical ICU brand, like I see you in the womb. So she came up with this, I just think, brilliant idea to brand it as Image Clear Ultrasound, the first three letters of those words being I see you. Hmm. So that's where the origin of the ministry comes from. And we've been deploying mobiles now across the country ever since. And so these mobile ultrasound vehicles are what they are designed to do is to go to the women in their neighborhoods and in their communities where they are, bring them free services with a lot of love, a lot of mercy. We lead with the service and the love. Then we go over their options with them, and then we share the gospel.
Hmm. And I really like when you were explaining this, kind of how the legitimacy of this as you described a very distinct business model for getting this done. And I like that at the heart of it, in addition to the gospel, is this idea that you articulated that is we can win, this belief that we can win. Talk about how, because again, I think that our generation is so like, this battle is never going to end. No one cares enough. No one, it's not going to be legislated. Mm-hmm. How can we win in this?
There's a couple of things. The first thing I'll say is you are right. I think this generation of Christians now is under the deluded assumption that this abortion issue is too big, mm-hmm. and it can't be won. And, you know, 55 million abortions every year in the United, or 55 million abortions since Roe v. Wade in the United States. So we see it as too big. The problem with that argument is that you are essentially saying that you have just identified the one issue in the history of the world that is outside the supremacy of the gospel, that is too big for God. Mm-hmm. And I think we all know there is nothing too big for our God. Mm-hmm. Our God is bigger than everything. So that's the first thing. I beg Christians to see this as the defining injustice of our time, mm-hmm. and to see it specifically and openly as a gospel issue, not as a political issue, mm-hmm. not as a Supreme Court issue. I firmly believe, and ICU Mobile believes, that what happens in our country with abortion is not dependent on the government, on politics, on the Supreme Court. It's dependent on those who follow Jesus and bringing it under the supremacy of the gospel. So from an ICU Mobile perspective, what we're doing is just that. Because we are a gospel-focused organization and we are going to women, our objective is to try to reach them while they're in the decision-making process. So we do a careful analysis of a community, and we understand by zip code, by neighborhood, where abortion is most prevalent. When we do that, that gives us a roadmap to where to deploy the mobile. So we can literally put it in the heart of where abortion is the most commonplace. And then by going into those neighborhoods, we're demonstrating a love and a compassion to these women that they're not used to seeing. A lot of times we hear from our clients, nobody ever comes here. Nobody ever comes to the hood. You know what I mean? It's Jesus going to Samaria, right, to have that purposeful interaction with that woman at the well. That was on purpose. You know, Jews didn't go to Samaria in those days. So our mobiles are going to these neighborhoods and communities with a message of love and compassion, the truth about what's happening with their bodies and their babies. We're providing them with all of the education. So this zip code mapping enables us to take a very business-minded approach. What that then enables us to do is to look at how many abortions are happening in a community. And from a pure business perspective, if you want to put your competitor business out of business, you need to win 25% of their business, right? So if I'm Starbucks and I'm trying to take Caribou out, I don't even know if there's a Caribou here, but Caribou Coffee's big in the Midwest, sorry. I'm trying to take out my competitor. I need to win 25% of their customer base. So we're looking at it the same way. If there's 10,000 abortions in a community, then we need to get 2,500 life decisions in order to make it an untenable position for the abortion clinics and Planned Parenthood to stay. So that means we need a certain number of mobiles to win that many life decisions. And so it's a basic sales funnel at that point. How many qualified leads come in the top? How many appointments do we set? How many appointments do we keep? How many life decisions can we get using all the metrics and the data that we track? And we're a very metrics-driven organization, so we're tracking everything.
Yeah. And so would you say where does it lie now as far as like medical clinics, you know, for life in ratio to the Planned Parenthoods and whatever? What does the battle look like?
Right now, in most cities, we're badly undermanned compared to the abortion mills and the Planned Parenthoods. Not necessarily in buildings. There might be the same number of buildings or the same number of organizations. We're undermanned from a marketing standpoint. Mm-hmm. We're undermanned from a community relations standpoint. We're losing the war of words in a lot of ways. And so women are drifting into the abortion mills and the Planned Parenthoods in numbers that are higher than the pregnancy centers. Mm-hmm. The other issue with pregnancy centers generally is that they sometimes lead too much with Jesus, and they lead too much with the pro-life messaging, and that will scare off an abortion-determined woman. Mm-hmm. We're not saying you shouldn't be all about both of those things, but we're just saying that you don't lead with that. You serve first, and then you introduce them to those things. So right now, you know, it's in most communities, there are a number of pregnancy centers, but we're just losing the battle to get the clients in the door. Mm-hmm. With ICU Mobile right now, with our fleet across the United States, we see 67% more abortion-determined women on our mobile than traditional brick-and-mortar pregnancy centers are seeing. That's not just more women, not more clients. It's more women who are determined to have an abortion, are walking onto our mobiles than going in the centers. We attribute that to the fact that we go to them. We end up in their neighborhoods. They don't have to go anywhere. It's very convenient. It's very easy. It's very safe. They're comfortable on the mobile. It's a clean medical environment, and it just enables them to feel much more comfortable coming to us.
Okay. So again, talking about where we are in the landscape of this, you use the imagery or the comparison of an abolitionist kind of metaphor to describe where we are with abortion today. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I think that when we look at ICU Mobile has never seen this as a political issue. You know, it's one thing I love about our founder and our board. They have always looked at this as we have to win the culture war one heart at a time, one family at a time. And that's really where the concept comes from, is that we look back to our abolitionist culture in our country and we see that's exactly what they did. They viewed it as not a political issue. The issue of slavery was not a political one. It was a heart issue. And they had to win the hearts and the minds of the people in order to put enough pressure on the government to ultimately make the decisions that they made to end slavery. And so we look at abortion as much the same way. Slavery was an effort to deny personhood to the African American. Roe v. Wade denies personhood to the unborn child. They're the same issue. fundamentally. And so in denying the personhood of the slave, denying the personhood of the unborn, we find this twisted logic that allowed us to enslave one and now murder the other. So what we look at from an ICU Mobile perspective is, how do we win one heart at a time? So by going into these neighborhoods and into these communities, reaching women right where they are with a message of life, not a message of death, a message of life, showing them their baby on an ultrasound, we can win the war one heart at a time. And when we win the war one heart at a time, we have the opportunity to influence the culture. And so that's how we believe this ministry works, is just getting to women and reaching them right at their heart level and showing them life.
Mm-hmm. What is the place, slightly rhetorical question, but I want you to be able to cast a vision here. What's the place for a young adult in this? Like young adults who, like I described at the beginning, are kind of like, well, I know what I believe, but I shouldn't impress that on other people, or I don't even know how to get involved, or maybe there's some kind of clinic in my neighborhood and I don't know. What would you, I mean, if you had the ear, which you do now, of thousands of young adults, single young adults, what would you say to them?
First thing I would say is what I said earlier, is to stop seeing this as a political issue, stop seeing it as a Supreme Court issue, stop seeing it as a government issue. If you read your Bible, which I'm sure most of your listeners are doing pretty regularly, you will see that God is a God of life, that everywhere in the Bible, he rejects the concept of destroying human life. And he definitely rejects it, you know, in his wording about when he formed us. Before he formed us in the womb, he knew us, which meant we were life to him long before we were conceived. This attributes the idea that we are all created in the image of God very plainly. So my challenge to believers of today is to see this issue as a gospel issue, to see it as a God issue, a Bible issue. It's none of the other things that are out there. That ought to spur them to act. You know, we are called to act on injustice. And abortion is the greatest injustice in the history of the world today. The numbers bear it out. You know, there's about 22,000 children will die today around the world from poverty or poverty-related issues. About 5,500 children today around the world will be victims of the global sex trafficking trade. Today, around the world, 115,000 children will die from abortion. It's the single greatest human injustice in the history of the world. And as Christians, as followers of Jesus, our hearts should break for what breaks God's heart. And God's heart breaks when children created in his image are destroyed. And so we should stand up and be a voice for the voiceless. So the next step for a Christian, I think, is to be a voice, to begin to say no more. Satan will not have any more of our children. That's the first step. The second step is to start motivating their church communities to speak up and act. We need pastors speaking from the pulpit on this issue. We need young Christians. We need the 20 and 30 something believers to start putting pressure on their communities to say, hey, look, why aren't we doing something about this? This is a tragedy. It's an injustice. The next thing we need them to do is get involved in the pregnancy care movement, frankly. When we look at around the landscape, we need more young people in the pregnancy care ministries. We need them on the front lines of this battle, winning hearts one at a time, ministering to these women with the love of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. From an ICU Mobile perspective, look, I'm a little biased because I know this works. I see the data all the time. It is without a question one of the most efficient and effective pro-life ministries in the world today. We need your help financially, frankly. If you can give a dollar, you can give $10. It helps us to get more of these mobiles on the road, more of these life-saving mobiles on the road. We need you to pray for us. Mm-hmm. You can come on our Facebook page and offer up praise and prayer. We do it all the time. We're always asking for prayer. You can call our office. I'm sure they're going to have an opportunity to get phone numbers and websites. We've got volunteer opportunities. You know, we can get you involved in your community. Maybe you're interested in deploying a mobile in your community. Mm-hmm. We can talk with you and try to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So I think the key is they have to see it as a gospel issue. They have to see it as supremely a God issue. And then they have to get behind the resources that are available to reach the women that are in crisis. And that's ICU Mobile and pregnancy resource centers.
Mm-hmm. I liked what you said when we were doing lunch prior to this about the type of women that you would love to see come in on the front lines. Like when the women come in, you know, you're like, we need those women who have tats and who have piercings and who look like the women that we're serving. And, you know, there's probably a deficit of that right now.
Absolutely. I mean, when I look across the pregnancy care movement and even in some cases on our mobiles, we don't have enough people that look like our clients mm-hmm. serving them. And so there's a mission field here. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would say to your listeners, that there's been a mission field created by the issue of abortion. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the greatest mission field of our time right now. And so see before you that mission field and act on it. There's a great opportunity for you to get involved, whether that's on our mobiles or whether that's on the pregnancy centers. We need young people that become skilled and trained counselors to work with these women in crisis. We need young people to go become licensed sonographers mm-hmm. so that when a woman comes on the mobile, she sees a girl that looks just like her. That's her age, that she feels like she can identify with. And yeah, sometimes that means you're going to have some nose piercings, and sometimes you're going to have some visible tattoos. that's okay. You know what I mean? All are called to this mission field. I think if you're a follower of Jesus, you're called to this mission field. It's not a question of if you are called. Mm-hmm. You are called. The question is, are you going to say yes to what Jesus is calling you to do?
Hmm. So just, Michael, as we close here, you know, we talk a lot at the Boundless Show about calling and about where God has placed us and how he moves us throughout different life stages and everything. And of course, you know, we alluded to you being in the business world and now doing this. What do you see, you know, like 5 years from now? I mean, do you feel, you know, I guess you feel like you have a unique calling to this, born out of your own story and everything, but just understanding what that looks like for that, you know, young adult who's kind of like, well, I really want God to use me and I'm trying to figure out what that looks like. What have you learned in your own journey?
Yeah, you know, that's, I was when God first called me to ministry right after I was saved, I was, you know, I was kind of like, no, you know, I took the advice of some people, but I just went kicking and screaming. And even in 2008, when he first called me, I was like, I'm really comfortable in my business. You know, things are good. I didn't really want to give it up. You know, I wasn't ready for that. But God showed me in scripture, I took the time to really pray. I took the time to fast. I took the time to dive into the word. I took the time to go to my accountability brothers. And they really guided me and coached me through this and affirmed some things for me that this was really God speaking and saying, you need to go do this. But what I would say for young Christians, 20, 30-somethings today, you need to do all of those things. But I think when you look around the world, this generation of believers cares about injustice in a way that no other generation of believers has. Mm-hmm. And they have a unique opportunity to do something about things like sex trafficking and poverty and all of those things. But I would challenge them to look at the abortion issue and say, look, this is huge. There's 1.3 million children being aborted every year in the United States. And as I shared earlier, that's 115,000 a day around the world. So it is the greatest mission field. And so I would say that you have to start asking God, what can I do about this? Do you want me in this mission field? And they're asking themselves, you know, a lot of Christians just like me, we're asking, you know, God says you are called. You know, in Matthew 22:14, Jesus says, many are called, but few are chosen, right? And I used to wrestle with that verse a lot. What does it mean to be chosen? Okay, so I'm called, but I don't want to be just called. I want to be chosen. What does that mean? And the parable that Jesus is using there is he talks about the story of the king who is inviting people to his son's wedding. And he sends out the first wave of invitations and they all say no. They make up excuses. Then the next group of invitations he sends out, those people all say yes. So if you're wondering where you're fitting in, you have to pray, you have to go to God, you're called to the mission field somewhere. I would suggest this is probably a good one for you to be in, but then you have to say yes. The difference between being called and chosen by God is saying yes. It's clear in scripture. We see it all throughout the entire Bible that people have to say yes to God before they're chosen. You know, and so I think that's the key is you have to get in sync with God. You have to really be asking him, Lord, I know I'm called to something. Reveal that to me and then give me the strength and the courage to say yes, because there's going to be a cost. There will be a cost, you know. Mm-hmm. Anytime you follow Jesus, you're going to pay for something mm-hmm. in that. There's a cost for it.
Hmm. Well, Michael, thank you so much for just, again, kind of giving us a glimpse into what you do as well as your heart behind it and really what God has done, I think, bottom line in your own life that has really borne a lot of this out and been able to, I think, shine a spotlight on it for our purposes and really giving us, I mean, I think it's exciting just to see what God's doing through ICU. And again, folks out there, you know, another young adult who's following God's call, doing what he feels God is telling him to do, even though, like you said, there is a cost to that. But so hopefully you will stay in touch with us here at Boundless. Again, I want to remind you guys, it's icumobile.org. Check it out. Like he said, I mean, feel free to go on their Facebook page, find out what they're about. You can give, you can pray for them. And so we would love to see you do that. So thank you again, Michael, for being part of this conversation.
It was a blessing to be here. And thank you for all you guys are doing. I love the Boundless radio program. So I was really excited to be here.
Thanks. He's a listener. Yay.
I am a listener.
Yay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Opening up this week's inbox, doing something a little different this week with Martha and I in the studio. Hey, Martha.
Hi, Lisa.
You know, sometimes we get questions and we just feel that we want to answer them. We're the experts here.
No. We are totally the experts.
Hardly. So we decided to do that this week because we got a great question from a listener that Martha is going to read and then we will discuss.
All right, here it is. What advice can you give me, a yet-to-be-married woman in her 20s who is eager to serve but is still in the process of forming a mature relationship with God, in finding a church? Is it wise at my age to break away from my family when searching for churches? Their beliefs differ slightly from mine. If so, what advice do you have for the unmarried when visiting churches filled with couples? Also, what is the best way to sort through overwhelming numbers of churches to find a good match?
All right, good question. And I want to land, first of all, on her idea of breaking away from family, because we're both very close to our families, and I know that jobs have brought us away from our families, but when in proximity, I mean, what was your take on that? I mean, did you ever have to think about that, or...
Well, if I still lived in the same town as my parents, there's like two options of churches.
Yeah.
So I probably would go to the same one.
That helps you make your decision, I guess.
Yeah. So I can't relate to that part too well.
Okay. But. Well, it's interesting for me because I, even now being in a different state than most of my family, I actually go to a different denomination now, which has occasionally spawned some conversations with my mother, you know, because I go to a pretty reformed church and I grew up much more middle of the road. And so, I think it's interesting though, because I think you can get kind of lulled, especially if you're in the church that you grew up in, you can kind of get lulled into that without evaluating and saying, okay, you know, where am I just going to this church kind of because it's here, or am I really investing in it and am I serving? Is it, you know, am I being fed? Am I contributing and stuff? So I think that's a good consideration. But okay, so both of us have had to find a church. How has that process been for you? What would be some good pointers that you would give, Martha?
Well, I am an introvert. And so one thing that's been helpful for me is just a willingness to go by myself and not having to find, okay, where are my friends going? And then therefore that's where I should go. Mm-hmm. But that's given me the freedom to find what really is a good fit and what I enjoy and what speaks to me and where I can serve. So that's one tip I would give.
Yeah. I think for me, I would say don't be so tied to the large churches or the ones where you know there are huge singles groups, because especially now there are so many cross-city opportunities for connection, and there are small groups you can be part of and whatever. And sometimes the best church, you know, that really is going to be a true community for you is maybe going to be a smaller church that's much more multi-generational. And I know I'm really stepping into that now, being part of a small church plant here in the city, and having to get out of that comfort zone of, oh my word, there's something hugely programmed for me that I can just slip into unnoticed, and I don't have that security anymore. So I would say, and you know, we've said this before when we talk about finding a church, you know, the first thing you have to evaluate is it preaching the word of God? I mean, is it solidly gospel-based? Is it infused with a spirit of grace and accountability? Are there people there that care about the Great Commission? What is the pastor's take on all that stuff? Is that sound? And to really evaluate that for yourself.
And really look at their website of what do we believe? And if it's part of a denomination, do the research, and you probably can't just visit once and know it all from one sermon.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong. I mean, I know, you know, currently with this plant I'm involved in, there are a few of my friends that go to that as well. And so that's great. I mean, we have our little kind of community within that, but we can't look to that as our comfort either. I mean, you're going to have to. I mean, how many of us have been in the spot where you feel like you're the new kid, you know, and you have to bust into someone's small group or do something, get involved somewhere. And it's just hard. And I think we need to acknowledge that there's always a point of transition on the front end where you have to be kind of uncomfortable. You're never, you know, rarely are you going to visit a church and just be like, I have come home, you know, and all of a sudden you're just ready.
And if you do feel that way, that's probably the place for you.
That's a good, that is
a good indicator.
A good place to be. So, yeah, so that's really helpful. I mean, there are other, you know, considerations to have as well, I would say. I mean, looking, you know, proximity. I mean, I know some people that, you know, decide that they want this church because they like the music, but they drive over an hour to get there. And I think that's going to be problematic down the road, because you want somewhere that you can plug into, that you can go consistently when they have things going on, especially midweek, and really feel like it's your community church. You know, I mean, you don't want to just be a commuter church person. I think that can be a little sketchy.
Yeah, she did ask, you know, how do I sort through just numbers and lots of churches? That's a good place to start, of what's nearby and what, you know, if you're looking for a certain denomination, that can help. Right. Limit your list.
And especially because so many churches are becoming much more community-based and they want to have an impact in their city or in their neighborhood and stuff like that. And that's a great way because eventually, you know, you want to be, you know, sharing the gospel with your neighbors and with your coworkers. And you want a church as they, if they get saved or if they're curious and they want to know more, that you can take them to and not say, well, yeah, let's, you know, save 3 hours to commute on a Sunday to go to this church that, oh, you've never been there, you know.
Unless you are from a small community. Mm-hmm. I actually, growing up, my family went to a church that was about 45 minutes away. Mm-hmm. That it's worth it if it's quality.
Right.
You know, like you really, I don't know. Sometimes there's reason, I think, to drive a long distance.
Well, and that brings up a good point, too, of just saying, don't feel like because that church is there that you have to be involved in it and, like, change it from the inside out. I mean, you know, there are some churches that are just broken and that aren't committed to the gospel and aren't committed to solid teaching or discipleship or whatever. And, you know, don't think that you're going to be this one-person savior for a church. You know, you need to be somewhere that you're going to grow as well as a place where you can plug in and serve. So.
Well said.
All right. Well, that is it for this week's show, everyone. We want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org so we can answer your question in the future. And let us know if you've had a church experience or finding a church that worked well for you. If you have some advice, something we may have left out, definitely weigh in on the blog so we can share ideas with one another, because this is something that definitely applies to us all, because you know that we don't go for just sitting in our rooms, in our bedrooms, listening to podcasts, if it's the Boundless show. Maybe if it's the Boundless show, you can do that. No, I'm just kidding. We're not your church, people. Listen up. All right. That is it. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.
A donor-supported ministry of Focus on the Family.